I'm the bull, Cincy. I'm the bull.
To the tune of the Wurzels.
Ah, that's a complicated one. I was going to do it to the tune of Chantilly Lace. On the Ball City. Yes, this is...
of the UK. And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 2 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes have killed almost 500 people, including 35 children. It's been the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. Israel says it's killed a large number of Hezbollah fighters. And earlier, the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told Lebanese civilians to leave locations used by the armed group. But Lebanon's health minister, Firas Abeid, said for many, the warning came too late.
If you look at the areas that were targeted, the vast majority, if not all of them, were civilian areas. And even, you know, if you look at the time between those messages that were sent and the time the attack started, you could see that this was not serious at all. I mean, the aim was just, in my opinion, is a show.
Harrods says it's investigating whether any current members of staff were involved in any of the allegations against the store's former owner, Mohammed Al-Fayed. One former employee has told BBC News a manager who they say still works at the store failed to investigate her complaint about Mr. Fayed's behaviour. Harrods says there's an ongoing internal review. Sir Keir Starmer will say there is light at the end of this tunnel as he addresses his first Labour conference as Prime Minister, but he will warn of a shared struggle through short-term pressures. In his speech, he will talk about a goal of creating a Britain built to last. Sarah Jones, a business and energy minister, says Labour needs to be honest with voters and agrees with the positive tone at the party conference.
Everywhere I go around the country, there are people with huge talent and that talent is being held back. And it has to be the job of a sensible Labour government in the interest of working people to say this is a long-term plan for growth, because that is the only way this country is going to grow.
An 8-year-old girl and a woman aged 40 have been found dead at a home in Salford. Greater Manchester Police say the bodies were discovered following reports of concern for welfare at the property. The United Nations report has found that Russians are now subject to systematic human rights violations, with all dissent brutally repressed. The investigation was carried out by the UN's special rapporteur on Russia, Mariana Kutsarova, who interviewed activists and lawyers in the country. She said punitive sanctions were being imposed for the most minor activities.
7 years for reading an anti-war poem or producing a play perceived to be anti-war. Two women are still in prison for that. 7 years for posting on social media a United Nations report about the Ukraine war. Journalists being imprisoned for up to 22 years on trumped-up charges, and as a warning to others.
And props, clothing and furniture from the set of the sitcom Friends have been sold in an auction marking 30 years since the show was first aired. The top-selling item was an official reproduction of the Central Perk Cafe's orange sofa, where the group often gathered. It sold for around £22,000. BBC News, it's 3 minutes past two.
I'm Kim Cattrall, and I want to tell you about my new podcast, a new audio drama telling the history of the CIA from the inside out.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked.
He's got to convince Congress to give him an open checkbook now.
America has suffered its worst domestic attack of the 20th century at Pearl Harbor.
How do we make contact with the NKGB?
Central Intelligence, starring me, Kim Cattrall, Ed Harris, and Johnny Flynn.
There's $50,000 in it for you if you say yes.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
This is our wee part of the United Kingdom.
Live from here at Old Trafford.
I think it needs a massive overhaul.
Dalton Adebayo. Listen on BBC Science.
Yeah, Colin in Dublin is going for Cobleraldo, for the Brazilian shirt name for Zoe in Northampton. She's a cobbler, or at least that's what the town was known for, and that's what their football team's nickname is. So Cobleraldo brings together Ronaldo, the great Brazilian centre-forward, and although it could be the other Ronaldo, couldn't it? But anyway, Cobreloaldo. Cobbleraldo. It's not as easy as you think, is it?
We begin to see the difficulty here, don't
exactly.
we?
Exactly. There is a jeopardy of live radio. Cobbleraldo is the suggestion from Colin in Dublin, whereas Scott in, is it Lantwit? He's just from Lantwit Major, is that a place? Anyway, Scott says potential Brazilian show name for Zoe is Schumacher. Why, Hugh?
Very
Hugh
good.
Hugh McDonald's with us. Oh, you
Brilliant.
Get it. Oh, you get it. Okay, well, then I don't need to ask Hugh, because if you get it, obviously Hugh gets it as well. 0808 590 9693. As well as trying to get a Brazilian shirt name for Zoe in Northampton, we're also asking you today to try and put your area on the map, if not your area, another area. We're trying to build a map of footballing Britain, if you like. So the places which have a historic, a historic claim to football in Britain can be put on the map for whatever reason. So, I mean, my favourite so far is the small town of Milford in County Armagh, where the penalty kick was invented. You're not going to get much better than that on a footballing map of Britain. But there are a few others. Hugh McDonald, the legendary Scottish football writer, is with us, and his suggestion for Drumchapel Amateurs, because that's where Kenny Dalglish came from, or in Postle in Scotland, is up there. So tiny place of Postle, I didn't even know it existed, to be honest. And Robin Nottinghamshire, of course, set us off by suggesting that Worksop Town should be on a footballing map of Britain, because it was the fourth oldest team in the world. And if that doesn't impress you, remember, it's a town of only 45,000 people, is or was Rob in Nottinghamshire's argument. And a strong one as well. We've got some others. A town that should be on the map is Bridge North in Shropshire, says Dave from Liverpool. John Alexander Brody was who invented the goal net. Was born in Bridgnorth.
Wow.
He also designed the Mersey Tunnel. You see, I'm not sure if that deserves to be on a footballing map of Britain. Because, of course, when we played football at school in the old days, you didn't have a net. It was just like a goalpost.
Oh, that's great. The first time you played, the first time you scored in a proper net, and you just watched the ball go in and then go down the net. It's such a wonderful feeling.
It's only Yakini of Nigeria who's really embraced the the reason why a football net is there when you score a goal, not least in a World Cup. The late, great Yakini, by the way. Are you for it, Hugh? Is it worth
it? I think the net's a terrific one, because I think once you grow out of, you know, jerseys for goalposts, and you go and you actually score and you play. When play when nets was always a sign that it got serious. You know, you're suddenly a big boy now. You were playing with nets. But the other thing about nets is there's so sort of many great things about football, and one of them is the sound of a ball hitting a net.
Yeah,
and you can hear it sometimes from thousands of miles away. See that? Even on the television.
Yes.
If you hear.
That's where they put the mics, isn't it? They put the mics there for a reason.
And isn't it fantastic when you hear that tish of a ball hitting the back of the net? It's just. I think the penalty one, though, is the guy inventing the penalty kick. I mean, that's pretty high up at the moment, isn't it? I'll take some catching.
I think it will. Milford is going to be up there, maybe the number one town in terms of its contribution to football in Britain. We'll wait and see. Oh, modern football started in Glasgow, says our listener, when Celtic poached all the best players from Hibs in Edinburgh, who were formed 13 years earlier. Hugh McDonald, would you like to comment on that?
Yes, I would. And I would like to say that it's absolutely and utterly true. It's factually correct.
That's the case for the prosecution rests.
Yeah, that is... I just threw myself upon the mercy of the court, Your Honour.
Yes, you're going to have to. Maybe several more times tonight. Brett, who's the London cabbie, says, I'd like to put Wilmslow in Cheshire on the map. Why? It was the birthplace of the greatest kit manufacturer in the world, Umbro, that we've discussed. Still making great and classy kits today, so sorry to hear about the gent as well. Yeah, we informed people earlier on that the Brazilian shirt name holder and classic from the World Football Phone-In for years and years and years, at least 20, more than 20 years, isn't it, Tim, since the gent was started with us? Well, he's passed away. And happy to take your memories of the gent positive, because you know what he was like, always positive. He always came, however ill he was as well, because even in, you know, when he was struggling health-wise, I went and saw him at his home in Orpington at the time. He'd moved from Greenwich, more or less, or if you like, Charlton, where he was before. As he was getting older. So I went and saw him. He was so pleased when I came to see him, I got to say. But, you know, he felt like a fish out of water, because I'd always gone to football matches with him. Then we'd gone back to his little cottage just down the road from Charlton Football Ground afterwards to have, you know, a cup of tea and a couple of chocolate bickies and everything. Lived next door to his missus at the time. You know, they'd both suffered bereavements of their partners and they got together. And I didn't realise how enamoured with her he was until I went to his place in Orpington and I saw this, you know, tributes to her on the walls and so on. Good old fella, the gent, and I remember him.
I love that in a very mature fella, that almost childlike optimism.
Yeah.
The next game was always going to be great, wasn't it? Yeah, Charlton or Poland, they were always going to be fantastic the next game. Yes. Wonderful.
Absolutely. Yeah, we're paying tribute to him as well, if you'd like to. So text me on 85058 or email dotun@bbc.co.uk. And the reason that we're asking you to contribute a place in Britain for our football map of this country, contribute a place that has had, you know, a football legacy, that's left a football legacy on the landscape. The reason we're asking you for that is because the Subutio World Cup took place in Kent over the weekend. Who would have known that Subutio, that kids game once upon a time, and probably the most legendary of all the football games, you know, in the real time football games, not the video kind, but it was invented in Tunbridge Wells. Now, I bet you none of you could have won that one in a pub quiz. Where was Subutio invented? Well, we now all know Tunbridge Wells, a town which is so innocuous, maybe, to the football landscape, but yet so important. That's why we're asking you to put a place into our football map of Britain.
I never would have known. I just assumed from the name it was like Italian, you know?
Yeah. Subutio. Well, I always assumed that Tunbridge Wells, from its name, was something from a Jane Austen novel, you know? It's right. Tunbridge Wells. And I've been through it and I thought, sorry, Tunbridge Wells, you're not for me. However, you're for many other people, don't get me wrong. But I just thought, you know, the last place on earth that you'd invent a little football game where kids flick their fingers to move the ball, although it's a game of skill, as we've learned tonight, I thought it wouldn't be a place like Tunbridge Wells. Maybe no. Southend-on-Sea.
It's a bit like, you know, all those Gerry Anderson things, like Thunderbirds.
Yeah. I'll go.
Stingray, Thunderbirds was the best. But Captain Scarlet and all of those.
He was good.
They come out of Slough.
Can we do that on another phone in?
This wonderful fantasy world that they created from Slough.
Let's save that for another phone in. That seems ideal for a World Football phone in as well. Anyway, we've got Mary with us in Bristol. We've got Edward in Widnes. So Edward has been waiting the longest, and thank you very much. Appreciate it. So Edward, let's go. You're a supporter of Liverpool.
Oh, good morning, Dalton.
Good morning to you.
A very good morning to your experts.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, Hugh McDonald's with us for the first time. I'm sure it won't be the last time. He's got stories for, you know, for
Hughie Mac, well, when are you coming back? Indeed.
Well, I'm a Liverpool supporter, but I don't know if your team know, but before Liverpool played there, it used to be Everton Ground.
Yes.
Yep. Everton played at Anfield from 1884 to 1891. Then he had trouble with the landlord, so he moved out and went to Goodison Park. And Liverpool took over in 1891. I'm still there now, of course.
Yeah, was that a mistake? Would you, I mean, if you had been the Everton owner at that time, would you have said, Lord Kirsch and Lord Kirsch? No, Scouse, how would you say that in Scouse? Lord Kirsch and Lord Kirsch and Lord Kirsch. I'm a Nigerian who went to Liverpool for just 1 hour. I was only there for an hour, Tim. It's not bad. It's not bad. Sorry, Edward, go ahead. Was it a good decision or not?
The thing is, Dalton, Everton were formed in 1884. Now, they're old, aren't they?
Yeah, of course, yeah. Then some team that came, fly-by-night team that was formed in 1901. Yeah, they would be, wouldn't they?
And the Liverpool team was full of Scots. The first Liverpool team, because the owner that took over Liverpool decided to make them, wanted to make them very good very quickly, and he succeeded, and he brought down all the Scots. And the first Liverpool team, as everyone know, was called the Team of the Max. Every one of them was Max something. that was the first thing, and it was actually a Liverpool tradition that every Liverpool supporter will know that was very strong until pretty recently. Actually, you know, it was strong in the glory years with Liverpool. I mean, a week ago that Ron Yates, the great yes. Scottish centre yes. half, yes. That Shankly built his team around.
You're right. I was just going to mention actually, he died, Ron Yates. He died last week.
And
when the last guy was on was talking about Liverpool when he played all in red. Now that's when Shankly introduced that, and he tried to shoot on Ron Yates. Mm-hmm. And he put him in the middle of the field, and he said, in the red shirt, if you all know that press, and he said, walk towards me. And when he tried to go up to him and said, listen, son, it'll take me 90 minutes to walk around you. You're that big. You look massive.
He actually said, I know pressmen who were there at these unveiling, and Shankly had said to them, do you want to meet our centre-half? And they all said yes. He says, you can have a walk around him.
That's right. But the thing is, I don't know what the oldest team is, but have you found out yet, Dalton?
Well, I think it's up in the air. I'm not going to make that decision for them, but they can argue out between them. What I was going to ask you, Edward, I mean, as much as, obviously, if we're talking about cities, Liverpool will always feature on a footballing map of Britain, let alone a musical map of Britain, let alone a humorous map of Britain, let alone a, you know, great place to live and get on with your neighbours map of Britain, etc., etc. There are lots of maps at Liverpool. Liverpool is... You can't avoid Liverpool if you're compiling a map of almost anything in Britain. But I wonder, the fact that Everton are a relatively old football team that used to play at Anfield or this, that and the other that you've talked about, is that their great claim to football legacy in Britain? I suspect, and I wonder what you think, Edward, but I'll ask you first, Tim. I suspect... Yeah. That, and one of our listeners, long-time listeners from years ago said this, and we haven't heard from him for quite a long time, but he said this. He said, look, Dalton, say what you want, but the football chant was, if not invented in Liverpool, was crystallised in the Kop, amongst the spectators of the Kop in Liverpool. I don't know whether we can say that's true or not, but it does seem credible to me, Tim. And would that be a greater legacy, the city that gave the football chant?
Other clubs had their chance, didn't they? There was like the Pompey Chimes, for example, you know, play up Pompey, Pompey, play up. So that there were little chants. But Liverpool, that effervescence of the early 60s and so on, they kind of taught fans to sing collectively. Some of this, I think, might have come from watching the rugby internationals on the TV, because some of the songs. Go on, Ed.
It could have been, but I'm going back. I started watching Liverpool, Shankly was in 1959, And of course, they had the Beatles music going then. And the cop used to sing all the Beatles songs. And it was an entertainment just to go listen to them singing. As
and they did a lot of Cilla Black's Anyone Who Had a Heart.
Yeah.
Well, it might be Dionne Warwick's, really.
I can't remember that, but I will say this, from what I've experienced going to Anfield, is the way that the football chants are organic. Ian McMillan, who's known sometimes, the poet, is known as the Bard of Barnsley. He told me of a moment, and this is a classic thing that I've experienced at not just Anfield, obviously, this is the organic bit about football chants that they can't quite do as well as we do it overseas. They just chant their chant and chant their chant. They don't react to something that's going on in the pitch. Mm. They don't have that conversation.
Oh,
with
do you remember like Gary
opposition.
Sprake throwing the ball into his own net at Anfield, the Leeds goalkeeper?
Yeah.
And the cop, totally spontaneously, careless hands. You started the chant.
Did you know what? When they got that goal, everybody went silent for a minute when it went in. And he got the ball out there and threw it out. And everything went quiet. And then they all cheered.
Yeah, what Ian McMillan said to me, which I thought encapsulated just how, you know, the Liverpool fans they're the most adept at this. He said that once when he was watching... he was watching Barnsley, his team, and, you know, he was with the ultras or whatever. And then they saw this amazing dribble. They watched it live and one of their players picked up the ball in their own half and dribbled about three or four or five, members of the opposition to score a goal. And then somebody spontaneously just said, "It's just like watching Brazil." And then somebody else chanted.
Someone picked up on it. Yeah.
It's just like watching Brazil. It's just like watching Brazil.
And there you've got a chant.
Yeah.
It's the opposite of so much that goes on now. And I wonder what we think about this, Huey. For example, it's something that's really big over here, and I hate mosaics. You know, you get into your seat in the stadium, and there's this piece of cardboard that you've got to hold up to be part of the mosaic or the piped music. And it's all telling people how they should support. And I think that's wrong. I think it's better when it comes organically from the fans.
Of course.
I think so as well. And one of the best organic ones I heard, when my kids were young, I used to take them to Stirling Albion, with a very small club in Scotland. There's still social worker still having still having an investigation into me for so doing, but I used to take the two of them when they were young, which still happened. And we're playing a very small team one time called Meadowbank Thistle, whose away support came in a minibus, the totality of it, and Stirling Albion and Meadowbank were at the bottom of the lowest division at the time, and Meadowbank scored, and the 12 Meadowbank fans stood up and shouted at the 150 Stirling Albion fans, "Going down, going down, going down." And the Stirling Albion fans immediately said, "So are we, so are we, so are we." Which I thought was perfect.
You know, there is a moment, though, when the chants come up organically. You're sitting there in the stadium and you don't quite catch what they said, so you're asking everybody to the left and right. What did they just sing there? And when you guess it, you are just dragged along with it. You know, it's literally, if you can imagine, so we're at Barnsley, so that guy's dribbling left, right and centre through the opposition, and he's just about to score a goal. And guess what? Oh, at first you don't hear it. It's just like watching Brazil. It's just like watching Brazil.
Now, what did Zoe say?
It's just like watching Brazil. Nobody's asked me to sing. So, anyway, it was as an illustrative point. It wasn't a wanton singing class that I sometimes give.
It wasn't gratuitous.
Gratuitous is the word that I was looking for. Thank you. You clearly went to a posher school than me, as you know.
I didn't.
You did. You did. Yeah.
I didn't. You went to a boys' school. No, I went to an ex-secondary modern.
Yeah. I don't think ours even qualified. I don't even think ours even qualified as a secondary modern.
We didn't need to burn down the science lab because we never had one.
For goodness sake. Hugh, I apologize. Sometimes when they go low, they go even lower. Let me just leave it like that. But we've got a first-time caller to the nightclub. Mary in Bristol, hello.
Hello, Darton. How are you?
I'm very
nice
well.
Nice to meet you.
No, absolute pleasure. You know you're a first-time caller?
Yes, but I don't want the song. It winds me up.
Oh my goodness.
Oh, I know it. Look, I'm of an age when I could sing it when I was drunk.
Yeah, yeah. I'm not going to ask you to do that. I'm not going to ask you to sing it when you're drunk, but I would ask you to just put your fingers in your ears.
Oh, yeah.
Your fingers in your ears. We'll have a barrel of fun. I hope this isn't going to wind her up. The blues on the run. Protocol is protocol, Mary. I know it winds you up.
I don't know. What am I going to do with you, Darton?
I am a Dalek. You can wind me up also. I am a Dalek.
Right. Well, I don't know where I'm going to follow Liverpool, but never mind. Plymouth, all right?
Yes.
I'm living in Bristol, but I follow Plymouth Argyle.
You're good. It just sounds funny. You know that.
The Argyle.
Look, come on.
Yeah,
we're doing bad enough as it is. Yeah, we got Wayne Rooney as our manager now.
Oh, that was a good look at one point, wasn't it? Hasn't he managed to turn things around?
I'm hoping so. Right, well, I think your experts will correct me if I'm wrong, but I've got a feeling that it wasn't so long ago that I discovered that the first black player to play in the Football League played for Plymouth Argyle.
No way. Come on, for
I
real?
I think so.
When was that?
Oh, way, way back. I think probably in about just after the war or something like that.
Which war?
No, it would have been the Second World War, I think.
I think
your experts would have to confirm that.
Well, never mind those experts. I'm an amateur and I can tell you this. I think Arthur Wharton takes the prize for the first black footballer, at least as far as people know, and that was as way back as 18...
Maybe it is long ago as that, then perhaps it's me that's wrong.
Yeah, no, it's not that you're wrong, but there might be another aspect to that story that the Argyle can claim as their own. You know, it might be the first black footballer.
Was just that something was brought up not so long ago, a few years ago, and I thought, I didn't know that at the time.
I think it was Arthur Wharton is what I remember. And
I'll leave that on here.
Sorry, but Wharton, the expert is here. Hugh, you're much more of a expert.
Well, Wharton certainly gets the nod for the first professional black player. There was a couple of black players, one called Wharton at Queen's Park, the great Scottish team in the early 1880s, who probably just gets in before Wharton.
And then there was Gil Scott-Heron's dad.
Well, Gil Scott-Heron's is one of the... He's one of the great loves of Celtic supporters, of course, because of his father, the Arrow, played. And, of course, Gil Scott-Heron's daughter is a fairly regular visitor to Celtic Park, where she's rightfully and justifiably treated like the queen she is.
Yeah, well, I'm glad to hear that, actually.
I think that the one from Plymouth is John Leslie from the 20s and 30s, who played many, many games.
I was going to say, I think it was John something,
But at the time of playing for the Argyle, at the time he played, he wasn't the first, but at the time he played for the Argyle, he was the only black professional player in England, which must have been some of a lonely.
Because stories like Wharton and like Walter Tull, you know, who played for Tottenham and died in the First World War, those stories, they got forgotten very quickly, didn't they?
I remember.
That's what I'm probably thinking of then, Dalton.
No, but that's good. Mate, look.
My other one, though he never actually played for Plymouth Argyle, he lived in Plymouth, and that was Trevor Francis.
And
he was the first player to have a transfer fee of over $1 million.
That's right. You got that spot on, but...
He was from that way, wasn't he? I mean, he made his name with Birmingham City as a teenager.
He played for Birmingham City. His mother wouldn't let him play for Argyle. We weren't good enough.
Let's go down that route. What on earth had Argyle done to Trevor Francis's mother?
Apparently they lived quite next door to my mum's best friend, and the best friend, they worked with the mum, and years afterwards, she said, we didn't want them to play for Argyle because they weren't a good enough team.
I still think that we should put Argyle? See, I can't even say Argyle now because of
Argyle.
You. Argyle. I think we should still put them on the map because of...
because also I'm finished yet, Dalton.
Oh, you ain't finished. There's more.
They're nicknamed the Pilgrims.
Yes, you are.
After the Pilgrim Fathers who sailed on the Mayflower from Plymouth.
Yeah, but there's been no Pilgrim Progress this week.
That's true.
I'm just checking.
Was it Michael Foote's team? Was it the one that used to follow around the country?
Michael Foote was our Labour MP,
He had to follow the Argyle.
One year they even registered him as a player when he was like in his 80s.
No.
Why did they do that? Yes. As a favour to him, as a kind of nice gesture, he was like registered.
Well, there you are. Then you know more about it than I do.
I think for that, they deserve to be on the map of Britain. When the question comes, which team registered an 80-year-old would-be Prime MP. Minister... Labour leader as a player. Oh my goodness! Because we have to have a humorous side of the map as well. You know
The other humorous side is that I think we were the first team to sing "Oggy Oggy Oggy."
Oggy Oggy Oggy. Oggy Oggy Oggy. I'm just singing it for the younger listeners who probably don't know what we're talking about.
I think we started that one as well.
That's the reason they go on the map. Or of many reasons, Hugh, what would you put Argyle on the map for? You know, given all that we've heard about the mighty Argyle, what should they get onto this map of Britain, footballing map of Britain
gosh,
for?
Oh, gosh, I don't know.
Hang on, not you, Mary. Hang on, Hugh.
I think an 80-year-old left winger.
Yeah, very good.
Quicker than some of the ones who've turned out for Scotland over the last few years, Hugh.
That was unfortunate, Tim. But you have to remind him about that.
Still crying about 1967.
I know. Are we going to mention the grass at Wembley at any point and how much we'd like some of that grass back? Not to smoke. Behave yourselves.
Can we have our goalposts back, please? I saw you, Hugh, sitting on top of them.
Oh, my goodness. That's gracious.
I was actually there that day, but I didn't make it down onto the park, unfortunately.
Look, we used to have a listener tell us about how he sneaked into the match when Scotland beat England.
Disgraceful one-man crime spree. I think he paid the train down.
He was.
He went and ate in Piccadilly and did a runner when the bill came.
He did have a good meal. He went from Scotland to Wembley without a ticket and without any money, and he had a great time. He saw a brilliant match. Sorry, go on.
That was kind of standard. At the time, though, I mean, that was kind of standard. I mean, I remember once getting on the train at Glasgow, and I was absolutely vilified because I was the only person who bought a ticket to travel on the train. And it became really, it became really obvious very, very quickly that buying a ticket for this train was the most stupid thing that anybody could ever do because any intrepid... the SAS wouldn't have gone onto that train. If the SAS had been ordered by Mrs. Thatcher to clear that train, they would have said, no, thank you. You know, we're not doing that. That's above the ground. We'll go for terrorists. But we're not going on that train to collect tickets because when they went off, there was always remember Houston. We got off, and there'd be about four or five sort of desultory ticket collectors at the gate who would look up and see this mass of drunken Scots heading towards the gate. And then suddenly find that they had other things to do at that precise moment and wander off into the distance. So nobody would buy a train ticket in those days.
Well, look, I did say there would be many other opportunities for you to fall at the mercy of Your Honour, and this might be one of them because I hear that the SAS are on their way now. 0808 590 9693. World Football Phoning with the great Hugh McDonald, with the legendino Tim Vickery, and with you, of course. We're looking for how to put your town, or the town you want to talk about, onto the footballing map of Britain. But first, it's 2:34.
The voice of the UK.
And the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News on 5 Live. Lebanon says Israeli airstrikes have killed almost 500 people, including 35 children. It's been the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly two decades. Warnings were given to civilians by Israel, but Lebanon's health minister says for many the warning came too late. Keir Starmer will say there is light at the end of this tunnel as he addresses his first Labour conference as Prime Minister later. In his speech, he'll talk about a goal of creating a Britain built to last. And an eight-year-old girl and a woman aged 40 have been found dead at home in Salford. Greater Manchester Police say the bodies were discovered following reports of concern for welfare at the property. Five Live Sport. Now, here's Shabnam Yunus-Jewell.
Everton could soon become the 10th club in the Premier League under majority American ownership. The Friedkin Group have reached an agreement to buy Farhad Moshiri's majority stake in the club, subject to approval from the Premier League, the Football Association and the Financial Conduct Authority. Manchester City fans are anxiously waiting on news of midfielder Rodri, who was substituted during the first half of Sunday's 2-2 draw against Arsenal. It's feared he could miss the rest of the season after initial tests showed damage to his ACL. City's three defeats last season came without the Spain international in the team. The League Cup tie between AFC Wimbledon and Newcastle has been moved to St James's Park next Tuesday after the London club's stadium was affected by flooding. The third round match was due to be played at the Cherry Red Records Stadium on Tuesday night. Four games are still on. Five Live will have commentary of Wycombe Wanderers against Aston Villa. Leeds United have announced plans to modernise and improve Elland Road. Part of the proposal is to increase capacity from just over 37,500 to around 53,000. The League Two Lancashire derby between Fleetwood and Morecambe ended in a 2-2 draw. And in cricket, Glamorgan won the One Day Cup for the second time in 4 years as they held on to beat Somerset by 15 runs. And on Five Sports Extra on Tuesday from 12:15, you can hear England against Australia in the third One Day International. England are 2-0 down in the series heading into that match at Chesterley Street.
Coming up this week on BBC Radio 5 Live.
Tomorrow at 8, 5 Live has commentary of Liverpool versus West Ham. Today there's ball-by-ball coverage of England against Australia in the third ODI on Five Sports Extra.
And tonight at 8, Aston Villa travel to Wickham in the EFL Cup.
5 Live Sports.
Listen on BBC Sounds.
BBC Radio 5 Live.
The voice of the UK.
On digital radio.
On BBC Sounds.
And ask your smart speaker to play BBC Radio 5 Live. Dotun Adebayo. BBC Radio 5 Live.
So we have learnt on this World Football Phone-In tonight that the Argyle, as they're known, Plymouth Argyle, once had a left winger. An 80-year-old left winger. It's true. Go and look for your pub quiz. Keep that one under your up your sleeve because it will come. The question will come. 08085909693. This is a pretty impressive map of footballing Britain that we've built up so far. Mm-hmm. Coventry's on it because they were kit manufacturers. And first penalty kick creator is on it. So Milford and County Armagh's on it. Dungannon is on it, not least because the former Ontario champion in Subutio now lives there. Seven Oaks in Kent was where the first, as far as we can tell anyway, the first sort of boys club that wasn't a school day kind of club to encourage or teach kids to play football was started in Seven Oaks in Kent by our listeners' dad. And Samhurst Primary School in Seven Oaks was the one that we talked about specifically in that time. So we've got all of these locations on our map of Britain's British football, if you like, or the British map of football. Either way, and I want to know which town, which city, which area you would put on it. Worksop Town's on it. You can't do, you know, worse than that, can you? If Worksop Town's on it, then where you live qualifies as well. Except they are the fourth oldest team in the world. And I know, fourth, yeah, what does that count for? But in a town of only 45,000, it counts for an awful lot, if you know what I mean. Brian's with us in Pitsy. Kathleen is with us in Aberdeen. We've got the legend Dino Tim Vickery with us in Rio. And we've got another legend, but of Scottish football in particular, certainly of Scottish football writing with us, Hugh McDonald as well. So, Brian, floor's all yours. Good morning. How are you?
Good morning, Don. I'm very well, thank you. Morning, Tim. Morning, Hugh.
Morning.
Yeah, Hugh, sort of direct this question at you, partially. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me why Glenbuck in Ayrshire should go on the map?
It's the birthplace of the great and wonderful Bill Shankly that we have spoken about earlier in the programme. But should I say, I think just go on the map. I think it should just go on the map because of the name of its local football team, which Bill, of course, played for. Without, even if Bill had come to nothing, surely having a club called the Glenbuck Cherry Pickers. I mean, you can't. I mean, surely you're going to put them on it. But yeah, Bill Shankly came from that. It was a little mining town in Ayrshire. There's a beautiful. Yeah. It's like a mining town. It's a hamlet, a village. It actually, in a way, doesn't exist anymore. It was a mining rose, what we used to call a mining rose. But there's a beautiful and very poignant memorial to Bill Shankly that has been placed there and is beautifully maintained. So he's not forgotten in that corner of Ayrshire.
Yeah, indeed. So legend of the game.
Yeah, Brian, you've got to give Hugh the props, though, because he got it right in one, didn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
I don't know if you've got another question, because my question, I've just seen you haven't got a Brazilian shirt name. What a shame, Brian. But I'll ask a question on your behalf, and the question that I don't doubt that you'd have asked was, how on earth did this great footballing legend, one of the greatest, certainly in terms of management, how on earth did he emerge from this hamlet, which barely exists anymore, called Glenbuck?
How did so many of them come from this kind of... You mentioned earlier on, Hugh, about Liverpool. When Liverpool got going, they just brought in Scots. And lots of English football was like that. And even my club, Tottenham, when they won the FA Cup 1901, you know, there's Scots already down there en masse. How did Scotland do it? What's the secret? Or what was the secret that you seem to have lost?
The secret was basically was participation, that it was the only thing you could do. You've got to remember, if you talk about Shankly, you would automatically sort of talk about Busby and Steen. They would be the great triumvirate of managers. You know, they'd rank very high as the greatest managers ever. I think they would be on a list. And they all had very, very similar backgrounds. Actually, Alec Ferguson, who's of a later generation, would have a similar background as well. There would be things that he would recognise in their backgrounds. And their backgrounds was, were in the cases of Shankly, Steen, and Busby, were mining backgrounds. They came from mining towns or mining hamlets, where the only recreation really was football. And football, it's a universal thing, isn't it? Why does the Kronk gym in Detroit produce so many great boxers? Or why do the favelas produce so many great footballers? football was certainly seen as a way out. You know, that was, you know, if you, I mean, Jock Steen always said that one of his greatest days was emerging from the pit, knowing that he didn't have to go back down it. So there was a real drive to get out of poverty. There was a real peer pressure. They talk about Glenbuck, for example. In Glenbuck, which is a tiny place of a couple of hundred people, there was four or five went on. I was going to say play for Scotland, but that might be, I would have to look at that, but certainly four or five went on from this small village to play professional football. You know, extraordinary, you know, the way they would come through. So it was a joint, it was a thing of the only thing that you had to do, the only recreation you had was football. Football was important, it was in the DNA, and it was also a way out.
I think you've just inadvertently, I'm sure other people have thought about this before, but you've inadvertently hit the nail on the head as to why football is so successful and why we should be, you know, landscaping a map of football of this country, because there was a time, and arguably there still is a time, when the only recreation available to people of a certain economic background, but geographical landscape or whatever else there might be as well, it's the simplest recreation if there's no other. And obviously with football comes athletics in a way, or at least, you know, in terms of keeping fit, jogging or whatever it might be, because that's part of football and that's a recreation. You can look at it like that. But with athletics, actually, there are some rules. And with athletics, you arguably have to have, you know, a opponent. You know, with football, you can kick it up against the wall for hours and hours and hours without any other opponent. And believe me, it brings you a lot of joy. In terms of recreation in that respect, I think that's a blinder. Anyway, Brian in Pitsy, I hope that answers your question. Well, it did, actually. He answered your question perfectly. And I hope I added to it, or Tim added to it. Kathleen is with us in Aberdeen. Then we'll speak to Gemma in Lichfield. Hello, Kathleen.
Hello, Dalton. Morning.
Good morning.
Fine. Right, Aberdeen should be put on the map because their coach, trainer, a Donald Coleman, came up with the idea of a dugout. He'd been in Norway and they had them there and he brought them back here. So Aberdeen was the first football ground to have a dugout. And then in England, the first football team is Liverpool because they'd come up to Aberdeen to play the Dons. And they saw this, so they brought it into Goodison Park.
It's amazing. Well, that's an amazing one. We would have overlooked this all day long. Aberdeen. Oh, yes. My word. Hugh, can you add more to this? Why was...
We'd have looked over the dugout, wouldn't we?
Well, the only reason I know about this is because there's a plaque in his memory on King Street in Aberdeen. And I got off the bus one day to see who this plaque was for. And now I've gone and Googled him, and it's all come up. And his great-granddaughter is the famous footballer, Rachel Corsi.
Oh, well, goodness. That's... you didn't know that, Hugh? You didn't know that?
No. Didn't know the dugout story. And obviously, I know Rachel Corsi. But I didn't know the dugout story at all. I mean, it's wonderful.
His right name was Donald Cunningham, but his parents didn't want him to play football, so he changed it to Donald Coleman. And Rachel thinks that was his mother's maiden name.
Yeah.
So he actually played football himself. I'm wondering...
Yes, he played football, yes. I'm actually played for Dumbarton up to the age of 47.
Well, he wins the prize for that one. Ouch, is all I can say. It must have hurt.
Michael Foote used to call him a whippersnapper, though.
typical left-wingers, right? This is such a great story, you know, that you're telling us here, and everybody's, like, nonplussed by it.
I love the direction this has gone in, you know. Yes. There's no knowing. This is the magic of radio. There was no knowing what we'd learned tonight. And we've learned about penalties and this is wonderful stuff. Goal nets.
The dugout, though, what's it good for, Kathleen?
Obviously for sheltering the people from the bad weather, plus the manager and the reserves would be nearer the pitch rather than sitting in the stands, wouldn't it?
Yeah, they would be. Or standing around, louting them up without, you know, any sort of purpose. Whereas the dugout...
Yeah, he'd seen this in Norway, and obviously they get slightly worse weather than we do, and they had them over in Norway.
Is that the only purpose for a dugout, Tim? You know, to shelter from the weather for you?
Well, to be close to the action as well, as you just mentioned. Yeah. Where else can you be? Remember, there's no substitutes in these days, so there's no need for substitutes there. But for the person who's selecting the team, you would like him or her to be as close to the action, to be able to communicate with the players. So you get some of that as well.
Yeah, the dugout today is a focal point for television cameras, amongst other things, Hugh, because we like to see the expression on the faces of the footballers, not least when they've been subbed off and so on. But it has become an essential part of a football match, hasn't it? Become
I mean, absolutely. Even at the weekend there, you watch Pep Guardiola turning around and taking a size 9 to his very expensive seats.
It was impressive. It was a kung fu kick. I mean, let's face it, Eric Cantona would have been proud of that. He was like, I got banned for less than that. Come on. I didn't even kick that high. I can hear, he would have said, I didn't even kick that high because when the sardines were coming for me, sorry, apologies. I went off on a tangent there, but I couldn't help it. Couldn't help it sometimes. Well done. I think this is an excellent one, Kathleen. Thank you very much.
Brilliant, Kathleen. Thanks for that.
I really, really appreciate that. So now we know why Aberdeen should be on a footballing map of Britain. It's not because Sir Alex Ferguson guided them to incredible victory during his time as a manager there. Yeah, they could arguably argue that one as well. But it's because there is the home of the dugout, Donald Coleman. Well, the more we can find out about Donald Coleman, the better. So if you know a little bit more, then add to it, please. We've got Gemma in Lichfield with us. Hello, Gemma. How are you?
Hello, hello, hello. I'm all right. How are you?
Very well, very well, very well.
Good.
Did you get that? Hello,
I did.
Hello,
very well,
hello.
Very well.
Yeah, why do I have to say it three times? Why do I have to explain my best jokes?
I don't know. That's your... I don't know.
Where does Lichfield...
Probably because they're not that good.
Where does... I'm laughing at the idea that my jokes aren't that good. They're so good, I'm laughing at the idea that they're not so good. That's how good my jokes are. We could be here all night doing a Groucho Marx, of course, but Gemma, why is Lichfield... Why should Lichfield be on a footballing map?
Right. Well, I live very close to Lichfield FC, which is where the little boys and girls play, and the big boys and girls play football, obviously. They make a lot of noise. I can hear them from my, you know, when I go to Lidl and that. Peter Ward, who played for England and Brighton and Hove, born in 1955, was born in Lichfield. And then he, I think Brian Clough changed his mind and didn't play for Nottingham Forest, but he went off to America to play there. But the reason I want to put Lichfield on the map is because basically all anybody knows about Lichfield is that we've got a cathedral and an ex-MP with a lot of hair and a flipping great, what's it called, train line coming through. And it's right, the HS2 is right by the football pitches and stuff. And I just don't want it to get diverted. I would hate it if, you know, our football pitch that the kids play on, you know, was dug out. That'd be awful. I wouldn't like that.
Especially as we've been talking about dugouts as well. You know,
I didn't know what a dugout was until I just heard that.
Yeah, well, now you know. Now you know the things you learn on the World Football Phone. So, Lichfield, why should we put it on the map, though? I mean, we can't say because Gemma in Lichfield doesn't want HS2 to go...
No, but you can say that there's a very good footballer who was born here with a fourth, something like, come fourth, I think, Staffordshire, in some league table of brilliant places for football. I mean, there's loads of, you know, okay, maybe not Lichfield, but Staffordshire. You know, there's great footballers come out of this place.
I
want to celebrate that. And 1955 is the year of Back to the Future. So you never know. Peter Ward might be listening from America. And he might be going, oh, my God, I better go back home to Lichfield.
OK.
Because we need some good, you know, we need some good footballers in Lichfield, because we haven't got, well, we've got his here, but he was born a long time ago.
You say 1955.
Mm-hmm.
I think we're onto something here, Hugh.
Mm.
You know, Hugh's the oldest one in this conversation. Sorry to rub that in, Hugh. I said only by minutes or months or a few years. But, Hugh, 1955, I can't help thinking of this fella.
Viva Las Vegas.
Do you know what I mean? Well, except it would have been Heartbreak Hotel, 55, I think.
Yeah. I was born in 1955, too.
There you go. I said you were older. You don't have to underline it, you know. We all know that.
Do you remember Peter Ward?
Yes, I remember Peter Ward well. Like, I remember Peter Ward enough to call him an inside forward. That's who old I am.
That's going back. Inside forward as in number eight or in the old stuff?
I think he was an eight.
An eight. Yeah. And Jimmy Greaves, don't forget, you know, there's some great inside forwards. Does he rank highly enough, though? Because Lichfield has other, I'm sure, reasons to be on a football map. As well as being the year that Elvis broke through. Anything you can think of, Tim?
No, I think while we share Gemma's anxiety for that pitch, we don't want that pitch to be taken away.
No.
Keep the pitch. The pitch. Yeah. While I think there's a consensus on this issue. I don't think the case has been proven beyond reasonable doubt that Lichfield should be on our map.
What about this mosaic thing? What's that all about?
So what mosaic?
He said that you've got to hold up a bit of paper to make a mosaic or something.
Yeah, this is something that it's becoming part of fan culture. I think it's been fan culture in parts of Europe for a while, where every seat in the stadium, there's a little piece of paper on it, and you all hold it up, and it forms a pattern all together. And I'm seeing it here in Brazil. I'm seeing it more and more and more. And people love it. People rave about the mosaics. And I don't like it because it's something that's all organised beforehand. And I like fan culture when it's spontaneous.
Yeah. I mean, like, mosaics go back a long way, don't they? And, I mean, like, the Mexican wave, does that still happen?
Yes. Yeah, that still happens. I prefer that because at least that's usually when the game gets disappointing.
When you go to a football match, you don't want to be part of a piece of art, do you, really?
Performance art.
Yeah, and by the way, I should tell everybody that Gemma's a musician as well, so she knows a little bit about performance art. And as you know, as a musician, it's live and direct and instantaneous, it's spontaneous. As much as you may have done your rehearsals and, you know, your harmonies with the other members of the orchestra, you know that anything can happen when you play it live. You know, there might
be. Unless,
as is increasingly happening these days with the big shows, it's all done on playback. You know, and then the playback is like the mosaic, isn't it? It's all been pre-organized, and you remove the spontaneity.
I don't know which big gigs you've
Madonna
been to.
Madonna did a big show here, and there wasn't a single musician present, not one.
Oh, my God.
You know, I'm sure she did that as an artistic statement because, you know, she's the kind of artist that she can afford a 100-piece orchestra if she wanted. My missus
played, there wasn't one there. What's the point of that?
Yeah, true. I was going to say my missus played the orchestra was about 30-piece, but the choir was 100-piece at the Bridgewater Gallery in Manchester. And there was a lot of jeopardy. Whereas when I was 13 or maybe 15, you're going to have to read my book to find out. And I don't think you'll find out if you read the book. But when I was about 13 or 15, I went and saw this bloke do it live. You know, live. Well, actually, this is what it sounded like when I saw him at the Mecca in Stevenage. It was either...
What, a bingo?
Yeah, it was a bingo thing, but not on the night that Bill Haley was there, because he is from 1955, the rock and roller that apparently kicked off the whole rock and roll thing when It was just rhythm and blues at one point, and a little bit of country western, and then it became rockabilly, and then Elvis did Heartbreak Hotel, and then this bloke comes up, and he was quite old. He was initially Bill Haley and the Saddlemen, but because Haley's Comet was about to come round again, they decided to call it Bill Haley and the Comets. Do you get it? And from that moment on, they then linked up with these tunesmiths from Tin Pan Alley, one of them called Jimmy something or other, and they came up with this foxtrot. This is actually a foxtrot, but you would know this much more than us, Gemma, because you know your music. This is a foxtrot, but because it became the soundtrack to a movie, Bad Boy movie called Black Ball Jungle, and you don't want to see him performing it at the beginning of Black Ball Jungle because there are a few obscene scenes. I know we're talking about the 1950s, Hugh, but you lot.
Yeah, Hugh, can you explain to me, why did your generation react to this by slashing the seats?
You're talking to a Glaswegian, and we would react to anything by slashing seats. Slashing seats is our go-to. That is what we do. Slash seats, so it wasn't a curiosity in Glasgow.
Yeah, well, it's better than slashing on seats. No, actually, is it? I'm not sure, but I know that you said that firmly with your tongue in your cheek, so we can go back to Glasgow. Breathe a sigh of relief, everybody.
The voice of the UK
and the home of the Premier League.
This is BBC Radio 5 Live.
BBC News at 3 o'clock. This is Charlotte Simpson. In his first speech to the Labour Party conference as Prime Minister, Sir Keir Starmer will warn of a shared struggle ahead to build a new Britain. But the Labour leader will also try to follow the Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, in presenting a more positive vision for the future and light at the end of the tunnel. Our political correspondent Ian Watson is at the conference in Liverpool.
I think the worry that some delegates have, and certainly some of the trade unions, is just how long is that tunnel going to be before they reach the promised land. So I think what he's going to try and do is give a glimpse of where he wants to get to, a country with greater economic growth, greater investment. There'll be a smattering of specific policies, I think, around skills, for example. And he'll be saying more on welfare reform because he has to obviously identify savings in the budget in order to put investment elsewhere.
Health officials in Lebanon say nearly 500 people, including 35 children, have been killed by Israeli airstrikes in the deadliest day of conflict across Israel's northern border in nearly 20 years. A spokesman for the Israeli military, Daniel Hagari, acknowledged the loss of life but said 1,300 Hezbollah targets had been hit.
Regarding the high number of casualties, everyone is a tragedy in Lebanon. Among those killed were a large number of Hezbollah terrorists who were next to the weapons that we targeted. Israel is facing threats on all fronts and continuing to act against them in defense for the people of Israel.
Official figures to be released this morning are expected to show a record low in planning approvals for new housing developments in England for the second quarter of 2024. It highlights the scale of the challenge facing the new government in meeting its ambitious targets for building new homes. Ben Chu reports.
The government has pledged to build 1.5 million new homes in England over this parliament, but residential planning permissions granted by local councils in England hit a record low in the first 3 months of the year, and figures for the next 3 months to June are predicted to show another record low. House builders say planning permissions are a leading indicator of future construction, and that their collapse this year shows just how difficult it will be for the government to hit its targets. Ministers